One sagging electrical line near Cleveland, Ohio, connected with a tree branch at 3:32 p.m. on August 14, 2003. And this began a chain of events which led to the largest blackout in American history. According to the most comprehensive study yet, the failure of this single transmission line caused a utility company in southern Ohio to overload and seal itself off from the now infamous grid. To the north, this created a huge need for power, and Cleveland began sucking an insatiable amount of electricity from Michigan and Ontario, knocking out more transmission lines and generating plants. When the need for power reached New York, power plants there sealed themselves from the grid in order to protect their own systems. This, however, created a new problem when New York, ironically, had too much electricity and overloaded its own system. The result, history's largest shutdown. Similarly, there are times when small actions and choices end with devastating personal consequences. And sometimes those consequences even spread farther than just being personal and can have an influence on the ones we love, the ones we care for. Sin often starts with one small choice, but it can end in ruined families, ruined churches, and ultimately ruined lives. For over 100 years, the Israelites had lived under the rule of three kings, Saul, and then David, and finally Solomon. These three rulers of the Jews were prominent and great in many ways, and yet they each made individual choices that would eventually devastate the kingdom of Israel. After Solomon died, a civil war broke out in his kingdom. As strife grew, the nation became divided into a northern kingdom, most often referred to as Israel, and a southern kingdom, most often called Judah. This division remained until both kingdoms fell to foreign invaders, and the Jews were led away into captivity. From the beginning of that division until Israel's captivity, for a period of over 200 years, the northern kingdom had 19 monarchs, and all of them were wicked. Can you imagine that? Longer than our country has been around, they had nothing but wicked leader upon wicked leader upon wicked leader. 19 kings ruling back to back, all of which who did evil in the sight of the Lord. And that era of evil prevailed until the Assyrians overtook Israel in 722 BC. The southern kingdom, on the other hand, was under the rule of 17 different kings for a period of over 300 years. Eight of these monarchs followed the Lord their God, but nine of them were wicked men who would not walk with God or serve him. The southern kingdom, Judah, collapsed with the destruction of Jerusalem in 586 BC. And the southern kingdom was later revived by men like Nehemiah, Ezra, and Zerubbabel. They moved back into the land. They built the temple. They restored the worship of the one true God. But during this period of the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom, because of the rampant evil of many of the kings and because of the apostasy of the Hebrew people, God sent different prophets, both to the rulers and to the peoples, in order to call them back to repentance. And being a prophet was not an easy calling. Most of the time, the rulers wanted nothing to do with these men. They didn't want to hear from them. They disdained their warnings. They ignored their rebukes. And most oftentimes, being that they were kings, they took care of it the best way they knew how. They'd kill them. In the book of 1 Kings, we have descriptions of each of these rulers. And it goes from bleak to bad and from bad to worse. And that's the pattern. There's murder, there's intrigue, idolatry, bloodshed, betrayal, greed, envy, strife of every kind. And eventually, we come to the reign of the king Omri, his reign over the northern kingdom, Israel. And here's what the Bible says in 1 Kings 16:25. And Omri did evil in the sight of the Lord, and acted more wickedly than all who were before him. Oh, great. See, of all the perversity of the previous kings, they all lead up to Omri here, and he's actually more evil than the rest of them. And you would think this was bad enough. But then comes the description of Omri's son, Ahab. We find this in 1 Kings 16:30. And Ahab, the son of Omri, did evil in the sight of the Lord, more than all who were before him. At this point, in the historical account of 1 Kings, there then comes the description of a certain marriage. And we find this in 1 Kings 16:31. You can turn there if you'd like. This marriage is very significant and has a huge impact on the people of Israel and on their history. It says this in 1 Kings 16:31. And it came about, as though it had been a trivial thing for him to walk in the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, that he married Jezebel, the daughter of Ethbaal, king of the Sidonians, and went to serve Baal and worship him. Now, without even knowing what comes after this, here's a huge clue to the significance of this woman on Israel's history. You see, the previous chronicles of the northern kingdom, never give the names of the king's wives. It's not a big issue. Now, suddenly, we're not only given the name of the king, Ahab, but we're also given the name of the woman he married. Now, why would God give the writer here a point to pause and just describe more detail of this particular marriage of a monarch? Well, it's not just because of the geopolitical ramifications, although those were there. There was an alliance being made with Phoenicia to the north, and this kind of marriage was commonplace when those types of alliances were made. But there's more happening here than just that. First of all, in this particular marriage, Jezebel, she was the dominant partner. She really ruled the kingdom. She had the power behind the throne. Ahab's administration was, in every sense of the word, a petticoat government. Jezebel ruled her husband and king, and because of this, she also ruled the people. Secondly, she was the one who initiated Baal worship. See, Jezebel's father, Ethbaal, was from Sidon, and he was, in fact, the king of the Sidonians. And Baal worship, which originated with the Canaanites, had long existed in that region, but the actual worship of Baal had not found its way into the hearts of the Israelites until it was introduced to Israel by this marriage to Ahab. In some ways, one writer put it like this: this was sort of Jezebel's dowry. She brought Baal worship with her. It's also important to note that she wasn't content to just have Baal worship coexist with the worship of the true God in Israel. No way. She wanted more. She wanted to overthrow everything that had been before. And she put strong efforts to that end, with Ahab doing very, very little to stop her. So Baal, just to know a little about him, he was worshipped as the god of rain and fertility. Interesting that this would be on today like today when it's raining so much outside, especially in Southern California where we don't really know what weather is. But he was the one who controlled the rains. He controlled the seasons, the crops, and the land. And when Baal worship entered the kingdom of Israel, the wickedness that accompanied all of its heathen practices just increased many times. But then, suddenly, a prophet of the Lord comes on the scene. The prophet Elijah. J. Oswald Sanders writes this about Elijah. Elijah appeared at zero hour in Israel's history. Like a meteor, he flashed across the inky blackness of Israel's spiritual night. Who better could have handled a pair like Ahab and Jezebel? Elijah was the rugged, gaunt prophet from Tishbeth. And he became God's instrument of confrontation at this critical time. Go ahead and turn to 1 Kings 17, verse 1, and hear how this event transpires. 1 Kings 17, verse 1. Now Elijah the Tishbite, who was of the settlers of Gilead, said to Ahab, "As the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, before whom I stand, surely there will be neither dew nor rain these years except by my word." It would be as if right now, in this very moment, I was to walk out here and just say to the rain, "Stop!" That didn't work. Let me try it again. "Stop!" See, I can't do that. But could you imagine if I could? What would you do right now? Most of you probably run out of here in total fear and panic. So it's probably a good thing that I can't. That would be an immense amount of power. And that would speak a lot to who I was speaking on behalf of, and the power of that one especially. And that's exactly what happened here. There was no rain. Now, who is this man, Elijah? He is someone of unusual importance. A very unique prophet of God. The prophets were all unique in different ways, but this man especially. He was one of two men who did not have to die. Wow. What does that mean? You see, Enoch was the other, of whom the Bible says this in Genesis 5:24. And Enoch walked with God, and he was not, for God took him. The only other man in all Scripture that God removes before death is the prophet Elijah. Secondly, he was one of two that God permitted to appear on the Mount of Transfiguration. When Jesus was there with the three of his disciples, what an amazing moment. The other one who appeared there was Moses. So you have Moses, the one who talked with God face to face, as a man talks to his friend, and Elijah. There's a third thing that's remarkable about Elijah. When Jesus would ask the disciples concerning the identity that the people ascribed to him, one of the regular ongoing answers was, Elijah! We see that in Matthew 16:14. That the people would even give that kind of answer demonstrates the importance of Elijah in their thinking. And they were remembering also God's prophecy through Malachi. In Malachi 4:5 it says this, Behold, I'm going to send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and terrible day of the Lord. And they saw that and they thought, this is who this man must be. Which when you think about it, for Elijah, that's a huge compliment. To be compared with the Lord, and even confused potentially by his coming. You look at the way he lived his life. There were times when God told him to hide, and he did. Later, God would tell him to come out from hiding, and not only that, come out and confront evil head on. And he did. This is a man who knew the fullness of walking exclusively with God. Do you? Do I? Let's learn together more about what this means as we come to 1 Kings 18, verses 16 to 46. 1 Kings 18, verses 16 to 46. This announcement by God's true prophet that it would not rain was really a challenge to the priests of Baal, to make it rain by the power of Baal. 3.5 years go by, and it still has not rained. The ongoing demonstration of drought declares to the people that Baal is not living up to what he's supposed to do. And all this time, it's becoming more and more apparent that Baal is not everything Jezebel has made him out to be. And now the prophet Elijah comes forward by the directive of God to bring the contest to a final, climactic, and convincing close. Let's pick it up in verses 16 through 19. So Obadiah went to meet Ahab and told him, and Ahab went to meet Elijah. Obadiah was another servant of the Lord who had actually helped other prophets to hide from Jezebel's persecution. And actually when Elijah first approaches him and says, go and tell Ahab I'm ready to see him, the first thing that Obadiah says here is, what, do you want to kill me? Why are you doing that? Because what's going to happen is, I'm going to go, I'm going to tell him that you're here, and what you're going to do is God's going to carry you off somewhere, because I guess this might have happened often, I don't know. He was aware that this could happen. God's going to take you, he's going to take you somewhere, I'm not going to know where you are, and then guess what? Ahab's going to kill who? You? No. Me! So why do you want to kill me? Was his response. I love it, very blunt. But then Elijah says, no, no, don't worry. I'm going to show myself to him today. That's not going to happen. So because of that, Obadiah goes. Verse 17, and it came about when Ahab saw Elijah, by the way, he's been looking for him for about 3.5 years, that he said to him, "Is this you, troubler of Israel?" And he said, "I have not troubled Israel, but you and your father's house have, because you have forsaken the commandments of the Lord, and you have followed the Baals. Now then, send and gather to me all Israel at Mount Carmel, and together with 450 prophets of Baal and 400 prophets of the Asherah who eat at Jezebel's table." So here he comes, and he says to the king, well, first of all, the king accuses him of being the troubler. And he quite bluntly says, "Hey, you've got this backwards, king. You're the one who's the troubler. You're the one that's brought this entire situation about because you have followed after the idols of your wife." And so he asked the king to have 450 prophets of Baal present on Mount Carmel, along with 400 prophets of the Asherah who ate at Jezebel's table. He also wanted to gather together the people from Israel, many of them, to the mountain. Why does he want to do that? He wants them to see what this contest is going to reveal. And you see, it's necessary that Ahab give this invitation to the Israelites because the leaders would hardly have dared to come otherwise, especially when Jezebel had such a tight hold on all the religious matters in the land. Now, why would Ahab even agree to this at all? Let's face it, Ahab wanted rain really bad. And of course, we can relate to that here as well. Most of us have been praying for rain for I don't know how long now. We've been in a drought. Now God's in. It's amazing that people still complain. You know, what is this? Oh, this is garbage. We don't need this. No, we really do. We really do. It's a good thing. Not to mention it's pretty. Isn't it pretty? You guys don't think so. Okay, well, anyway, I think it is. But it's beautiful and we need it. And so did Ahab. And so what happens here is he agrees to this because he's hoping, hey, if this brings rain, I mean, the reason he was even walking around at that point in time is they're going to try to get the cattle somewhere so they wouldn't have to kill him because of the lack of water. So now we come to a confrontation here. Well, another confrontation, I should say, in verses 20 to 24. So Ahab sent a message along with all the sons of Israel and brought the prophets together at Mount Carmel. And Elijah came near to all the people and said, "How long will you hesitate between two opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal, follow him." But the people did not answer him a word. Then Elijah said to the people, "I alone am left, a prophet of the Lord. But Baal's prophets are 450 men. Now, let them give us two oxen, and let them choose one ox for themselves and cut it up and place it on the wood and put no fire under it. And I will prepare the other ox and lay it on the wood, and I will not put a fire under it. Then you call in the name of the Lord your God, and I will call in the name of the Lord. And the God who answers by fire, he is God." And all the people answered and said, "That's a good idea." So everyone arrives here at the top of Mount Carmel, and the people are there, the 450 prophets are there. It's interestingly enough that nothing is mentioned about the 400 prophets of Asherah. Apparently Ahab couldn't arrange for the other group to come. It's possible that Jezebel objected significantly enough that they didn't arrive somehow. But the numbers were still sizable, and it's likely that there were even more spectators there than there were prophets, and we'll see why that is a little later. But the outline of the contest here is given. The prophets of Baal were to call upon their God to light miraculously on fire this altar to Baal. And later on, Elijah was to do the same thing in respect to the altar to the God of Israel. And then the one true God would answer by fire. I love that. The people are like, "That's a good idea." They finally respond. Oh, they wanted to see the contest. This is bigger than the Super Bowl. I mean, this is huge. They're ready. They're like, who's gonna win here? Who's going to take this thing out? They can't wait. So then we see the challenge, verses 25 to 29. Elijah tells the prophets of Baal something. He begins like this. So Elijah said to the prophets of Baal, "Choose one ox for yourselves and prepare it. First, for you are many, and call on the name of your God, but put no fire under it." Then they took the ox which was given them, and they prepared it, and called in the name of Baal from morning until noon, saying, "O Baal, answer us." But there was no voice. No one answered. And they leaped about the altar which they had made. And it came about at noon that Elijah mocked them and said, call out with a loud voice, for he's a god. Either he's occupied or gone aside, or is on a journey, or perhaps is asleep and needs to be awakened. So they cried with a loud voice and cut themselves according to their custom with swords and lances until the blood gushed out on them. And it came about when midday was past that they raved until the time of the offering of the evening sacrifice. But there was no voice, no one answered, and no one paid attention. So Elijah tells the prophets of Baal, you select your animal, you start. Now, why would he have them select the animal? Well, this way there's no charge at all of tampering with the animal in any way. They picked it, they brought it, they prepared it. He had nothing to do with that. And they sacrifice their animal. They begin to call upon Baal to send fire. And they continue all morning, and they continue up until noon. And then they continue on through the afternoon. And at this point, Elijah mocks them. Maybe he's gone aside. That phrase is interesting. A guy named Dr. Ron Allen, he was one of Pastor Rich's Old Testament professors, he believes that the wording here suggests that really Elijah is taunting them with the idea that perhaps Baal has stepped into the celestial men's room. Somehow he's detained at this time. That Elijah's taunting the prophets of Baal, they call still louder, and they even cut themselves with knives. They harm themselves, all to no avail. And as the afternoon wore on, Baal did not answer. But then Elijah goes before the Lord. Let's read in verses 30 to 39. Then Elijah said to all the people, come near to me. So all the people came near to him. And he repaired the altar of the Lord, which had been torn down. And Elijah took 12 stones, according to the number of the tribes of the sons of Jacob, to whom the word of the Lord had come, saying, Israel shall be your name. So with the stones he built an altar in the name of the Lord, and he made a trench around the altar, large enough to hold 2 measures of seed. Then he arranged the wood, and cut the ox in pieces, and laid it on the wood. And he said, fill 4 pitchers with water and pour it on the burnt offering and on the wood. And he said, do it a second time. And they did it a second time. And he said, do it a third time. And they did it a third time. And the water flowed around the altar, and he also filled the trench with water. Then it came about at the time of the offering of the evening sacrifice that Elijah the prophet came near and said, O Lord, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, today let it be known that thou art God in Israel, and that I am thy servant, and that I have done all these things at thy word. Answer me, O Lord, answer me, that these people may know that thou, O Lord, art God, and that thou hast turned their heart back again. Then the fire of the Lord fell and consumed the burnt offering and the wood and the stones and the dust and licked up the water that was in the trench. And when all the people saw it, they fell on their faces and they said, the Lord, he is God. The Lord, he is God. Then Elijah said to them, seize the prophets of Baal. Do not let one of them escape. So they seized them, and Elijah brought them down to the brook of Kishon and slew them there. It's late in the day. Elijah calls the people over to a place where there had been a small altar to Yahweh. It had been torn down and neglected long ago. He repairs it. He uses 12 stones, one representing each of the tribes of Israel. This would have been a pretty insignificant looking altar compared with the larger altar that the Canaanites would have used to worship Baal. A Canaanite altar dating even earlier than this moment in time was found at a place called Megiddo, and it measured 26 feet across and roughly 4.5 feet high. It was made of hundreds of stones cemented together with mud. So this particular altar on Mount Carmel may have been smaller, but doubtless it was still sizable in comparison with the small one that Elijah would have been using. So Elijah also digs a trench around the altar, and he calls for 12 containers of water to be poured on it. And it drenches the altar completely. It proves, without a doubt, look, there's no secret fire under here. I'm not trying to pull a fast one. This wood, have you ever tried to light wet wood before? You ever been camping? You know, it's usually when you need the fire the most, and you're out in weather like this, and you're sitting there, it's not happening. It's hard to light wet wood. But what does he do? He has them pour it, just drench it with water. But then Elijah offers a brief prayer. The purpose of the prayer is this, that the people may know that thou art God. And God answers with fire. The fire of God falls and consumes the wood. It consumes the stones in the altar. It consumes even the dust of the ground. The fire licks up the water in the trench. What a picture. Undoubtedly, if there were those nearby this blaze, they would have had to move back to just escape its heat. And they immediately cry out, "The Lord, He is God! The Lord, He is God!" And then the false prophets are slain. That's why probably there were more than 450 people there. They needed to catch all 450, and they needed to take care of what God desired at that point in time. So the execution was carried out effectively, and God's word was fulfilled, and His desires done. But some could read this part of the account and say, you know, that's kind of extreme, don't you think? Not a little, kind of over the edge. You know, take them all out and one, you know, that's kind of barbaric in some ways. Is it really? Would you think, or what would you think of a physician who found a mass of growing malignant cancer cells in your abdomen and said to you, "I think we better remove just some of those cells. I'd like to do just a little bit of minor surgery here." No. A good physician would see that deadly mass and would say, "We've got to get all of those cells out of there, along with any surrounding tissue that might be contaminated." That's not extreme. That's essential. That's wise. The prophets of Baal were an immoral, hostile, and anti-God malignancy in the land of Israel. Elijah knew they had to be cut away in every sense. There needed to be no evidence left of such a godless menace as these men. After that powerful demonstration, something else happens. God brings rain. We see that in verses 41 to 46. Now Elijah said to Ahab, "Go up, eat and drink, for there is the sound of the roar of a heavy shower." So Ahab went up to eat and drink. But Elijah went up to the top of Carmel, and he crouched down in the earth and put his face between his knees. And he said to his servant, "Go up now, look toward the sea." So he went up and looked and said, "There's nothing." And he said, "Go back seven times." And it came about at the seventh time that he said, "Behold, a cloud as small as a man's hand is coming up from the sea." And he said, "Go up and say to Ahab, prepare your chariot and go down so that the heavy shower does not stop you." So it came about in a little while that the sky grew black with clouds and wind, and there was a heavy shower. And Ahab rode and went to Jezreel. Then the hand of the Lord was on Elijah, and he girded up his loins and outran Ahab to Jezreel. So what happens is Elijah stops, and he waits, and he waits. Now in those first moments of waiting, do you think he's going, "Nothing, huh? Whew. Maybe you better go up again." But it seems like the demeanor of that would be probably my demeanor. I think his demeanor was more of utter confidence. It was just waiting. Waiting on what God would do. And sure enough, it came. And God gave us an illustration of it even today. This wasn't a minor, this was a downpour. Saturating the land that was ravaged by this drought. As we consider the passage we've looked at, we're going to see three qualities of God so that we can know the fullness of living exclusively for Him. Three qualities of God so that we can know the fullness of living exclusively for Him. And the first thing we see is God's preeminence. God's overwhelming superiority over man-made idols is beyond measure. Look at the amazing series of contrasts presented here in this account. You have 450 prophets on one side against one. You've got a huge altar, you've got a small altar. You've got 3.5 years, no rain. You've got one afternoon, rain. You've got degradation and pain as the prophets cut themselves up and mutilated themselves. Versus one humble prayer. You've got no response whatsoever from an idol who does not even exist. Versus a massive, huge, powerful, potent response from the living God of the universe. God and God alone gave the people what they wanted, even what they needed the most. And yet, what had they been chasing after this whole time? We look at the practices of these ancient pagans and we think, ugh, those Canaanites, what could they do? How could they worship that way? And then we see how it infiltrates the people of God. We think, oh, how could they fall for that? Some sick things. The cutting was just one element of that that we see in this account. We're shocked at the awfulness of their idolatry, but let me ask you this. What are the idols of your heart that you devotedly worship? What are they? And if we really consider that, maybe we won't be so shocked. What are you really after in life? If you are in Jesus, do you see how much you already have? If Danny Simpson had known more about guns, he probably would have chosen not to rob a bank. But in 1990 in Ottawa, Canada, this 24-year-old went to jail, and his gun went to a museum. He was arrested for robbing a bank of $6,000 and then sent to jail for 6 years. He had used a .45 caliber Colt semi-automatic, which turned out to be an antique made by the Ross Rifle Company in Quebec City in 1918. The pistol is worth up to $100,000. Much more than Danny Simpson had stolen. If he had just known what he had carried in his hand, he would not have robbed the bank. In other words, Danny already had what he needed. Jeremiah 2:13 says this, "For my people have committed two evils. They have forsaken me, the fountain of living waters, to hew for themselves cisterns, broken cisterns that can hold no water." Don't fall prey to the lie that something is going to satisfy you more than God Himself. I tell you, it will not. And many of us here are setting our hopes on things like careers, on financial success. We're setting our hopes on education or families. These are blessings of God. They will not satisfy you. And God will not take second place to any of them. He alone is preeminent. Idols lie. Does that show American Idol? How appropriate. In America, we've got a lot of them. It's a lie. And we need to cling tightly to God's preeminence. The second quality of God we see is His perspective. His perspective. In verse 21, the prophet asked the people, "How long will you hesitate between two opinions?" It's interesting. The word for hesitate here means to limp. So oftentimes we waste so much time being indecisive rather than stepping out in faith and making God-honoring choices. And so we're torn because, you know, we want to choose God, but we kind of want this too, and we go back and forth. I want to serve God with my life, but I also want this. And this attitude reveals that really each of us have our own agenda. And we hesitate. We need to understand something. In God's eyes, divided allegiance is just as despicable as open idolatry. That's His perspective. One writer put it this way: if Jesus makes you feel comfortable with your agenda, then He's not Jesus. Once you domesticate Jesus, He isn't there anymore. Are you trying to live between two opinions? If so, you need to make a choice. That's the call of Elijah to us. Live for Christ or don't. If you stay where you are hesitating, you're not really living. You're limping. What do you think of your life up to this point? How are you spending your time? How are you spending your talents? As believers, we must not be mediocre. We dare not sort of dissolve into the background or blend into the neutral scenery of the world. It's sad because sometimes you've got to look awfully hard or talk awfully long with someone to even find out if they're a believer or not. It's a long time sometimes before an individual will declare their allegiance to God. Is that what we've created today in this age of tolerance and compromise? In our culture, in our schools, our offices, our factories, our lunchrooms, our boardrooms, everywhere that there is to be in this culture, we need men and women of God. We need young people of God who are going to stand firm and say, "I stand with the Lord." Because it is He before whom I stand. Like Elijah. We need to be prepared to stand alone if that's what it takes. Just like Elijah. But how is your integrity? Have you compromised your principles to stay in business? To get a good grade? To make the team? How about to be in with the in crowd? to earn the next rank and promotion? Do you find yourself today winking at language and behavior that a few years ago would have caused your stomach to turn? Are you compromising morally right now because somehow, some way, you don't want to be considered a prude? Chuck Swindoll put it this way: those who find comfort in the court of Ahab and Jezebel can never bring themselves to stand in the gap with Elijah. So this passage today displays for us not only God's preeminence and God's perspective, but also God's provision. We see God's provision here in many ways. We see it in His providence. If we go earlier than we were able to see today, how God keeps Elijah hidden. Or even in the section after today, as God keeps Elijah as he runs. But we also see it in God's turning the people's hearts. I love that in verse 37, part of the prayer, that thou hast turned their heart back again. That's what God does. He initiates, He takes hearts, and He turns them. He alone has the power to turn the soul. But even most significantly, we see God's provision here in prayer. What is it that precedes the fire falling down out of heaven? Prayer. The most amazing tool ever given to humankind. The prayer of faith. Prayer has always been and always will be the most powerful thing on earth. It's our participation in working with the Omnipotent One. He answers prayer. I love the account of Hudson Taylor, the missionary. And his son speaks of how he would give himself to pray always. His son's name was Howard Taylor, and he wrote this. Quote, "The sun never rose on China for 40 years, but that God did not find my father in prayer." Unquote. As we come to a conclusion, we need to ask ourselves, do we find our hearts hesitating between two opinions today? We must not let it continue any further. We need to make the choice, and we need to learn to live, embracing the preeminence of God, understand His perspective on living with a heart divided between Him and idols, and we need to enjoy His provisions, always faithful, always true, satisfying every need. And as we do so, may we be those who stand, even alone if need be, for His praise, for His glory, and ultimately His pleasure.